Coming up on this episode, we're counting down the top racing greyhounds ever. Author Charlie Blanning and former NGA Executive Director Gary Guccione share their best of picks next on Greyhound Nation. This is Greyhound Nation, episode 33, recorded November 19th, 2022. Charlie Blanning and Gary Guccione, racing's top five greyhounds. Greyhound Nation is a podcast for greyhound enthusiasts produced by Greyhound Enthusiasts. To learn more about our show and its hosts, visit our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. Welcome to another episode of the Greyhound Nation. I'm Michael Burns. Now, here's your host, John Parker.
Welcome back, Greyhound lovers. We have two special guests today. How often do you get to talk to two former keepers of Greyhound stud books at the same time? Coming to us from England is Charlie Blanning, and from Rapid City, South Dakota, Gary Guccione. Welcome, fellas.
Morning, John.
Hi, John.
So today I've asked Gary and Charlie to come up with their view of the five greatest racing greyhounds of all time. We're going to go back and forth. They're going to tell you a little bit about each greyhound, why they picked him. We're going actually in oldest to newest, most recent. And I think you'll find it a fascinating conversation. They may even challenge each other or have a couple of questions for each other on their picks. So, Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, my first one, John, is I think probably not only the earliest, but the greatest hero of greyhound racing here in the UK. And that is a wonderful dog called Mick the Miller. Now, Mick the Miller was born in Ireland. He was bred by a Roman Catholic priest called Father Brothy. And after he'd run some 20 races in Ireland, he was brought over to England to contest the 1929 Greyhound Derby. And in the first heat at the marvellous White City Stadium, which was the home of the Greyhound Derby in those days, he smashed the track record and was so impressive that everyone rushed with the pound notes in their hands in their attempt to buy him. And someone bid him £500, and the good father decided that if people were that keen, well, why not have an auction? So he said to the management of the White City, let's auction my dog here on the steps of the terraces of the White City, which is what they did. And a man called Albert Williams paid £800 for him. Now, £800 today, £800 then is worth about £200,000 today. Just £200,000 when you've seen a dog run for the first time. So that seems sort of pretty extraordinary in itself. And it's history now that Mick the Miller went on to win the 1929 Greyhound Derby. And then he came out and won it again in 1930. And by then he had become the darling of the crowds in England, particularly at the White City. We're talking about crowds when they had the 1930 Greyhound Derby. There were 100,000 people there to watch him do it. Quite extraordinary, quite extraordinary. But in the meantime, Albert Williams, who had paid £800, something like £200,000 for him, decided to sell him again. And in a private deal, he sold it to a man called, sold Mick the Miller to a man called Hugh Arundel Kempton, who was the managing director of the stadium at Wimbledon. And Arundel Kempton gave him £2,000 in late 1929 for Mick the Miller. That's worth £500,000 now. And he bought it as a present for his wife. You won't be surprised to hear that his wife was an exceedingly attractive girl. She was called Fiddy Arundel Kempton, and for the next few years, she was forever to be seen in the gossip magazines of the day, in the picture magazines, like the Tatler, with Mick the Miller. And together, Fiddy Kempton and Mick the Miller became an institution. I mean, there was never a greyhound in this country like him ever again. And eventually, he won 61 out of 81 races on the track. And at one point, he broke the world record for the sequence of wins by winning 19 races in a row. I could talk about Mick the Miller all day, so I'll stop now.
Well, no mention of him would be complete if we didn't talk about briefly about his silver screen career.
Oh, yes. Well, in 1934, after he'd retired, the Ealing Studios, of which the head, Michael Balcom, was a great Greyhound fan, he was always at the White City, decided he'd make a feature film about Greyhound racing, starring Mick the Miller. And the film was called Wild Boy, and they spent mega bucks on it, which they never got back. But it's a smashing film. And the real star of the movie is Mick the Miller himself, because he was such a personable dog. He had the waggiest tail that you've ever come across, with a great big white tip on it. And it was forever wagging backwards and forwards. And of course, the more the crowd cheered, the more he wagged his tail. If he hadn't existed, we'd have had to create it in some way. He was just wonderful.
Yeah. Great dog. Gary, let's go over to you.
Yeah. Well, John, I have two dogs, actually. I'm going to call it a tie between these two, but they're both old timers. And one Charlie's very familiar with, and that is Traffic Officer. This was a Greyhound right at the dawn of Greyhound racing in the United States. Traffic Officer was bred in Iowa by a fellow named Art Wilson. Art and Traffic Officer, of course, are both in the Greyhound Hall of Fame. That was back in an era when Greyhounds were given nicknames, such as were the great baseball players of the 20s, 30s, 40s, and even 50s. And they called Art Wilson and Traffic Officer the Gilbert and Sullivan. And Charlie, I might have taken some of this info from your book, Please, Mister, where you talked about Traffic Officer. But he was also known as Big Flatfoot, Big Copper, but his most popular name was Big Red. He was a Triple Crown type of star for U.S. Greyhound racing. He actually excelled at coursing initially, then on the racetrack, and then he was a super sire. He's in the pedigree many, many, many times of all of the Greyhounds here in the United States today. He was a 76-pounder, which was a big Greyhound back in those days. The late Orville Barber back in 1971, he had seen him race, and he said he would look like a mother duck being chased by her ducklings going around the racetrack whenever he was in the lead, which was most of the time, of course. He was sold to a Leon Wolf from Cincinnati, who ended up selling it to a Traffic Officer to George Oswald for $3,500 is all. Quite a difference from Mick the Miller back in his day in England. He won the National Coursing Futurity in 1926. Again, he was a track standout. He mostly ran in match races in which there was no betting. He eventually, he earned about $20,000 in purse earnings is all. And he raced at quite a few outlaw tracks back in those days that opened and closed very quickly. Eventually, he ended up with Oswald and Caliente, and he won a $5,000 match race in his very last race, which would be worth about $60,000 today. They once started him 50 yards behind the field, and he still would win. He would just plow through the Greyhounds. He is also known as the Greyhound or the grandfather of the American Greyhound today. He died at the age of 11, and Charlie and I have still not been able to locate the statue that was erected to him in somewhere in California. Correct, Charlie?
So I understand, yes. Yes, yeah. It was Mr. Oswald, I think.
Mr. Oswald. And I put him in a tie with Flashy Sir, who was amongst the first three Greyhounds that were inducted into the Greyhound Hall of Fame. He was purchased at a coursing meet in Abilene for $800 by the team of Merrill Blair and Cal Ollinger. He had nicknames as well back in his day. He was called Mr. Greyhound. Eventually, he was called the Seabiscuit of Greyhound racing. He won $50,000 in a single year of racing. This was back in the 40s. He ran at 13 different tracks, which in my way of thinking was one of the things that separated the really great ones. They had this versatility to be able to run at lots of different tracks, and Flashy sure did that. He's most remembered for his match race series with another Hall of Famer, Lucky Pilot. It was the best of seven. Maybe they were emulating the Baseball World Series back then. And Flashy Sir won the first three rounds of that series at Flagler. The fourth round was won by Lucky Pilot at St. Petersburg. But then Flashy Sir closed it out in the fifth round. And it was the only race of the five races in which a track record was not tied or broken. So it was quite a memorable event. Flashy Sir did not go on to have a great sire career. I think he passed on fairly early. But those two kind of bring the 20s and the 30s and 40s. Rural Rube was another one that was a star in the 30s. But that kind of covers the early era of greyhound racing in the United States insofar as greatness.
Yeah, Gary, you mentioned that the when they had back in the heyday of the match races, which I'd certainly like to see them bring back. But you mentioned there was no wagering on those. But was there purse money?
Oh, yes, there was purse money. As mentioned with traffic officer, I think that the purse was a $5,000 match race. And sometimes the owners would put up some of that. Sometimes it would be the track. But his very last race, he defeated Gold Leaf in a match race that earned him a $5,000 purse. So, yeah, they usually had some money at
that. And was there a reason they didn't allow gambling on the match races?
I don't know what the deal was back then. I was a young boy. No, I wasn't even around, John, to know. But I know that later on there was match racing with win wagering only in match races, such as during the Downing and Rooster Cogburn era. But back then, apparently, they didn't see fit for that. I don't know. There might not even have been pari-mutuel at some of these. There might have been bookies. They had all sorts of schemes to get around the laws at the time to make wagers. So I'm sure there were a lot of side wagers going on and private wagers. But
No doubt.
Yep.
Well, for sure, two memorable greyhounds. Charlie, let's go back over to you.
Right, John. My second dog is a dog called Endless Gossip. Endless Gossip won the Greyhound Derby in 1952, and there was something remarkably distinctive about him, and that was that both his parents had won the Greyhound Derby before him. Both his sire, Priceless Border, who'd won the Greyhound Derby in 1948, and his dam, Narragar Ann, who then won the Greyhound Derby in 1949. And a man called Ernest Gosher, who never had anything really to do with greyhounds before, he was a famous cattle breeder, and he was already in his 80s. And Ernie Gosher decided he'd try an interesting experiment, so he bought Narragar Ann after she won the Greyhound Derby, mated her to the Derby winner of the previous year, to see what would turn out. Well, what turned out was Endless Gossip, who was perhaps, you know, one of the fastest Greyhound Derby winners ever. His time in the final stood for years and years, probably about 20 or 30 years. And he was the most remarkable Greyhound. He also won a classic, which is known as the Laurels at Wimbledon Stadium. And the other extraordinary thing about him was that Ernie also tried something else revolutionary, that having won the Greyhound Derby in 1952, he then attempted to win the Waterloo Cup with Endless Gossip on the coursing field in early 1953, just about 6 months later. And he almost did it, because they ran him in some trials. At a meeting up in the north of England, his trainer who was a very famous trainer and also coursing slipper called Leslie Reynolds, took him to this coursing meeting to try him in some trials to see just what Endless Gossett would do on the coursing field. Well, the first thing he did was to lead his first opponent. And then after half an hour, in the way that they did in those days, not much concerned with welfare as they are now, they put him back in slips and ran him again. And this time he ran against a dog called Holy Stone Lifelong. And he led Holy Stone Lifelong and beat him. And it's history that a year later, not in the Waterloo Cup that Endless Gossett ran himself, a year or so later, Holy Stone Lifelong won the Waterloo Cup in 1954. So there we have Endless Gossett. He won the Derby on the track. He beat the Waterloo Cup winner on the coursing field. And he was also, at the time, a very good a success at stud. Something, by the way, which Mick the Miller didn't manage to achieve. He was a disappointment at stud. But Endless Gossett still lives on, as I know Gary will tell you, in pedigrees, both on this side of the Atlantic and in America as well.
Was Endless Gossett nominated? Did he get his nomination for the Waterloo Cup by virtue of his racing performance?
Well, if you're organizing a coursing event and someone said, may we run the winner of the Greyhound Derby in it, what do you think the answer would be? They were absolutely thrilled to have him, as you can imagine. And when he was eventually beaten, which was in his third course at the Waterloo Cup, it was only after he had led a considerable distance to the hare for the first turn. He was the fastest, but then a very clever dog behind a very clever hare managed to run up enough points to beat him. But yeah. He was surely probably the fastest dog on the field at the Waterloo Cup that year.
Yeah.
In those days, they didn't care where they ran them. And certainly if you were Ernie Gosher in his 80s, and he probably said to himself, you know, I'm only here by the grace of God. Let's see what we can do with these dogs. And he found out.
Well, that was true versatility, that's for sure. All right, Gary, let's go back over to you.
Yeah, just a footnote on Charlie's comments on Endless Gossett. I believe they imported him to the United States, and he produced one of our great sprinters of the, it would have been the early 1960s, Big Gossett, who was absolutely the fastest of his day. But he failed at stud, he would win races by incredible margins. Unfortunately, he would wear himself out toward the end of the meet when they would be running the big stake races, and he so oftentimes failed in those major stake races. But Big Gossett is a Hall of Famer here in the United States. My next pick is Real Huntsman, and there are many old-timers that will tell you he may very well have been the best of all. Real Huntsman was owned by the Randall family, Gene Randall in particular. He was noted for his 27 race win streak. And amazingly, he did that at 7 different racetracks. So he was traveling all over the country. Didn't matter what track he was on, he could beat anyone. He also ran in 9 different match races in his day. He won them all, everyone. So clearly, wow, he was the class of his time. He won the second American Derby, I think it was in 1950, and then he followed up and won it again in 51. He held 6 track records at various times, and they ranged from distances of 1/4 mile up to 3/8 mile. So his versatility was just unquestionable. Derbies, he won 12 derbies and stake races over the course of his career. He won $62,000 during his racing career. He was among the first 3 inducted into the Greyhound Hall of Fame, along with Flashy Sir and Royal Rube, back in 1963, 10 years before the Hall of Fame Museum was even built. He died tragically in a fire, so very little impact was made by Real Huntsman as a sire in this country. But unquestionably, one of our top 1, 2, or 3 greyhounds of all time, possibly even the GOAT, as we call him in America anymore, for the greatest of all time. Very possibly. He would garner a lot of votes for that.
Yeah. A star for sure. And that, what a tragedy that he died young in a fire. That's just too bad for him. Too bad for the breed as well. Charlie, let's go back over to you.
Well, my third one, John, is Pigalle Wonder. And people often wonder about his name, because a lot of people pronounce it Pigalle Wonder. But it should be Pigalle, because he was named after the Pigalle nightclub in London. Because what had happened was that when he was originally named in Ireland, where he was bred, he was called Prairie Champion. His breeder always called his dogs Prairie This and Prairie That. And there were many legendary dogs, you know, bearing that prefix. But a man called Al Burnett bought him for a lot of money over the telephone. And Al, of course, wanted the dog to be named after his club. So changed the name, and he became, instead of Prairie Champion, he became Pigalle Wonder. Al Burnett, the owner, there's quite a nice little story about his name as well, because Al Burnett wasn't his real name. His real name was Aaron Isaacs, and he was born into a poverty-stricken Jewish family in the East End of London. And when Aaron was about 14, he got on a cattle boat and went to America in an attempt to make his fortune. Well, when he came back again, not long afterwards, he'd suddenly become Al Burnett, stand-up comedian. I am assured that Al was probably the worst, corniest comedian that you ever heard. You only had to hear his act out with Pigalle to know that. But his dog, Pigalle Wonder, was absolutely fabulous. And Al was one of the biggest gamblers in London at the time. He always spent his evenings, he'd go to a track early in the evening, and then about midnight, he would go back to his club and start telling corny jokes. So he was quite a character. Pigalle Wonder, apart from being a very handsome dog, beautiful dog, and also being tremendously fast, was great success at stud. He got two winners of the Irish Greyhound Derby himself, one of which was called Wonder Valley, which was an enormous success at stud in Ireland at the time. And he also had a dog called, I think it was Tivoli Dreamer, which was exported to Australia. And after a couple of generations, he got a dog called Temley. Now, in Australian pedigrees, Temley is absolutely legendary. For instance, a recent very influential sire, both in America, in Europe, and also in Australia, called Brett Lee, he traces directly to this dog. So he traces directly back to Pigalle Wonder and dear old Al Burnett. Love his story.
Well, that's good to hear. I have a few Brett Lee descendants of my own, and that's interesting to hear about. Gary, let's go back over to you.
Well, my number three choice, now we're up to the mid-1960s, which was right around the time I was getting interested in greyhound racing. My dad owned some greyhounds. And this greyhound would become my personal hero and favorite over the years, and that was Westy Whizzer. He was bred by a grocer that lived in Westmoreland, Kansas, and he always gave his greyhounds that prefix of Westy because he was from Westmoreland. And Westy Whizzer was often just called the Whizzer. Again, they were still using these nicknames for the greyhounds. Interestingly, the guy that raced him was a guy named Swede Wilson, C.C. Wilson, Swede. And if you think that nickname was a little unusual, you ought to have met his brother, Fat. They were both honored as brothers at a banquet at the NGA many years later. But Westy Whizzer was just a sensation right from the right from the start. He won the Taunton North and South Match Series, and he won 13 out of 17 races that initial meet as a pup. He would go on to capture track championships and great fame at four different tracks: Raynham, Mile High, Taunton, and Palm Beach, which reminds me that how back in those days greyhounds traveled so much because tracks were seasonal, whereas in the last 20 or 30 years, when tracks became year-round, they didn't have that opportunity as much. So they really had an opportunity to show their versatility at run at different courses and different distances. Wizard was strictly a sprinter, however, except they thought that they would try him in the Raynham Derby back in 66, I believe it was. He not only won the Derby, but in one of the elimination races, he broke the 3/8 track record. This was by a sprinter, mind you. So it just showed what kind of class this greyhound had. He won 107 races in his career. He was one of the few greyhounds to be named to the All-America team in three consecutive years. Late in his career, he was actually won the national championship, win championship with 49 races in 1966. Near the end of his career, he was so famous in Taunton, and they knew it was his last meet there, they threw him a big birthday party, cake and everything at the races. A couple days later, he came out and won his very last race at Taunton Racetrack. He went on to be a champion sire. He's in the pedigrees of most greyhounds today here in the United States multiple times. He was inducted in the Greyhound Hall of Fame in 1983. I had the privilege of taking a picture of Wizard when he, after he'd retired to stud. He was a little flighty of a greyhound. He was kind of a one-man dog. He was always real close to Swede Wilson, his kennel operator. But he was that kind of a greyhound, a little fidgety. We called him spooky back in those days a little bit, but he was definitely shy. But what a champion he was.
Yeah, I can remember Dennis McKeon talking about, you know, back in the day when greyhound racing received a good bit of coverage on the sports pages of newspapers, and that whenever the Wizard was running, it would just swell the attendance, you know, for that night, whatever card he was on. So we don't have those much anymore, unfortunately. Charlie, let's go back over to you.
Well, my fourth champion, John, is the greyhound which pulled all the headlines over here in the 1980s. And he was called Ballyregan Bob. The unusual thing about perhaps this choice is that he didn't win the Greyhound Derby because he was a distance dog. His best distance, I suppose, would have been over 725 yards, not over the classic middle distance of the Greyhound Derby in those days, which was 525 yards. But Ballyregan Bob really captured the imagination of the public over here because he set up an extraordinary sequence of wins, which eventually finished at 32. When he beat the record, which previously had been held by an American dog called Joe Dump. But to win 32 races in a row was quite an extraordinary achievement, both for the dog and also for his trainer, who was an enormously popular man, sadly no longer with us, called George Curtis. Gentleman George Curtis, he was always known as, and he was a gentleman. And also very nice people were the people who owned Ballyregan Bob, Cliff and Jesse Kevin. Cliff died before I could meet him, but I did meet Jesse, Cliff's wife, when they were registering Ballyregan Bob at stud. And extraordinary thing about him, I didn't really know until fairly recently, was that, of course, at one time he was in the States at stud. But I don't think he attracted a great deal of business. I'm also informed by one internet note that he even stood at stud in Germany, but not exactly the centre of the greyhound breeding world. But not a great success at stud, although he commanded a very high fee to begin with. mainly because, and this is a personal prejudice of mine, that as a sometime breeder of greyhounds, I wouldn't use a greyhound which didn't have at least some showing of early pace. And so I'm thinking that sort of dogs that I like are dogs like Pigalle Wonder or Endless Gossip. But a staying dog, not for me as a stud dog. But Bally Regan Bob, like Mick the Miller, was an enormously popular dog with the public because he used to win his races coming from behind, and there's nothing more exciting than that. So for a greyhound purist like myself, I like to see them get out of the traps, up to the first bend in front, and then, as we always used to say, good night. But dogs that come from behind, they're the ones that thrill the public. That's the one the public love.
I can remember seeing Bally Regan Bob. He was one of the most, the last modern greyhound, I think, who was preserved through taxidermy. He was on display at the 2000 Greyhound Millennium, which I thought was, unusual. They had Fullerton, they had Bed of Stone, some of the really old time greyhounds, but Bally Regan Bob was lived to be stuffed, so to speak. So that was an interesting thing to see him. And I think he died as quite an old dog because the stuffed version looked quite elderly.
Yes. When he appeared at Newmarket, he had come from his glass case at the National History Museum in Tring. And I can assure everyone he's still there and he's in the same glass case as the beloved Mick the Miller and also Fullerton, who back in the 1890s won the Waterloo Cup four times. And so those three great greyhounds, all of whom lived to a very decent age, are there growing away quietly in a glass case in the National History Museum at Tring. Everyone can go and see them, and they should.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, Gary, let's go back over to you. Who's your next pick?
My next pick is the only female of the group. Interestingly, we just inducted another female into the Greyhound Hall of Fame last October in Abilene. Well, last month. And that was Husker Magic, a tremendous racer in Florida. But this greyhound was one of the greatest of all time. And it was in the same era as Westy Wizard. But she was more of a distance racer. So the Wizard and Miss Whirl never hooked up. But Miss Whirl, she was a 54-pound wonder. She just was an amazing greyhound. She had it all. She could win at any racetrack. She could run at a lot of different distances. She broke track records. She was based in Central Florida. She was owned by Ralph Ryan and raced for the Larry Hughes Kennel. She really put her name in lights when she captured two Flagler International Classics. And back in that time, mid-1960s, the Flagler Classic was clearly the number one stake race in America. She won it twice. She went to Wonderland to have a match race between Flagler and Wonderland, and she raced against LL's Bilko. Well, she defeated him very easily in both races, which further enhanced her legend. She won 115 races during her career. She had such a long career. She not only made three All-American teams, but she was honorable mention in a fourth team. No other greyhound has ever done that in America. She went on to be an outstanding producer. Among her pups was the well-known Axemaker back in his day. And she was inducted in the Hall of Fame in 1982. Virtually by unanimous vote, I'm sure. One of our greatest greyhounds of all time and a female. We look upon her as the greatest female racer of all time, and that was Miss Whirl.
You know, there was a great thoroughbred racehorse named Whirlaway. I wonder if Miss Whirl was, if her name was inspired by Whirlaway. Any ideas on that?
I don't know if there was anything. There was nothing traditional that went on with Larry Hughes and Ralph Ryan as far as naming any greyhounds. But they did name the clubhouse at Sarasota, I believe, the Miss Whirl Club. So that was quite an honor She was not stuffed and put in a museum, but she had a clubhouse named after her, which unfortunately with racing ending in Florida a year or so ago, is just no longer. But we'll always remember Miss World as one of the truly great ones in America.
I really enjoy hearing about these greyhounds that were so involved in match racing. When did that fall out of fashion, Gary, in the U.S.?
You know, it was after the Rooster Cogburn and Downing match race of the 70s. There was talk of other match races happening, but it just didn't seem to materialize as often anymore. I think there was a concern among some owners about having their greyhound beaten in a match race that would hurt their chances at stud and not look good on their resume after they retired. And so there were so many that just didn't happen. I was reading recently about Unruly, who was hoping to, F.B. Stutz, Happy Stutz, was hoping to get him in a match race against another fellow Hall of Famer, Marathon Hound. But Unruly suffered an injury and it never happened. There was talk about Pease Rambling and Understood, Pease Rambling being a champion down in South Florida at Hollywood, and Understood, the great sprinter at Derby Lane, never came about. And so there were a few other ones of lesser fame that came about, but it really kind of really started the falling off after the Downing and Rooster Cogburn match race. And that would have been in the 1977.
Yeah. That's a shame. I think that could really reinvigorate greyhound racing here in the U.S. Charlie, let's go back over to you.
Yes. The last one I have, John, before I get on to that, can I say something about match racing? It was enormously popular in the U.K. when greyhound racing started. And they frequently had matches on the card. Mick the Miller, for instance, ran in 14 matches, one of which the greatest that he ran, and they matched the winner of the Greyhound Derby against the winner of the Greyhound Oaks. And Mick the Miller had won the Derby, and the Oaks winner, who was called Faithful Kitty, they ran them in a match at Wimbledon over 550 yards. And at the end, only half a length divided them. Mick the Miller just getting over in front of the line in front of the Oaks winner. And it was terrifically popular with owners who would lay down enormous sort of side money for them. And all of a sudden they disappeared. And I've often puzzled myself over it. And I think probably I've only just seconds ago come up with the answer. Match racing in our country disappeared when totalizator betting was legalized. In the great days of match racing in this country, it was all bookmakers. And people bet like crazy on matches with bookmakers. But as soon as they had pool betting, the managements, of course, wanted as many dogs going round the track together as they could to expand the pool and expand the odds as far as possible. So I think it's pool betting, certainly in the UK, which killed match racing as much, perhaps, as some of the owners not really fancying, putting their dogs' reputations on the line. But I understand it's making a great comeback at the moment in Australia. And as everything that happens in Australia these days happens in the United Kingdom next, perhaps we'll get match racing back over here.
Who knows? That'd be great.
Anyway, my fifth dog is the only one of my choice that I've actually held on the end of a lead. And that's Westmead Hawk, who won the Derby twice in 2005 and 2006. And how it happened that I just happened to have Westmead Hawk on the end of a lead at one point was that in very early in his career, he ran in the Greyhound Studbook Trophy, which the Greyhound Studbook, of which I was the keeper, sponsored at Monmore Green in Wolverhampton. And it was one of his earliest races, and Westmead Hawk won. And at the presentation, the man who was handling Westmead Hawk that night really didn't have enough hands to receive the trophy and the congratulations and pose for the photograph and so on and so forth. So I got to hold Westmead Hawk, the future dual derby winner. And no, I didn't let him go either. So that was a great honor. But Westmead Hawk, he was a fabulous dog. Nick Savage's breeding, Nick Savage trained him. And again, he had this great thing, was that he was not entirely dependent on early pace. And in fact, in his second derby, I was lucky enough to be there to witness it at Wimbledon, where the derby was run in those days. He came literally from last to first in the last couple of hundred yards to just get up on the line to win his second derby. Everyone cried. Not a dry eye in the house. Absolutely fabulous. And I'm very pleased to say he then, when he was retired to stud, he was as success as that as well. He got two Greyhound Derby winners himself and lots and lots and lots of very good Greyhounds. Smashing looking dog too. Wonderful dog. Westmead Hawk.
Was he friendly when you took his lead?
Well, I don't remember him biting me, so not. So anyway, and I have a photograph to prove it too. There I am holding a Greyhound Derby. Wish I'd put him in the car.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Gary, let's go over to your number one.
Well, this is the
or your final Greyhound, I should say.
The final one. And arguably he could be number one. I think it would be a photo finish between him and Real Huntsman in a lot of people's eyes that would look at the full history of the sport here in America. And that is the Great Greyhound Downing, raced by the White Shadows Kennel, managed by Jim Frey throughout his career, Texas-bred Greyhound. And he was the right Greyhound to come around at the right time in Greyhound racing, and everything about his career was managed just so wonderfully and perfectly. And he responded to every challenge that was given to him in such a dramatic and amazing way that his fame, I don't know if it's exceeded by any Greyhound here in America, but he raced back in the 1970s. And he started out his career after just a few starts. He took on the best sprinters in the country and won the Hollywood World Classic, and then came back and won the Hollywood Futurity. He was promoted by a great promoter back at Hollywood in those days, Roy Berger, who managed to get him on national television on a show showing the replay of his Hollywood World Classic victory that year. And then it was followed up by two feature stories in Sports Illustrated. And maybe that was the closest Greyhound racing in America ever came to becoming a truly nationally followed sport. We were called the seventh largest spectator sport in America for a time, but never had that national exposure like some of the greater other sports, baseball, football, et cetera, had. He was called a precocious pup by Sports Illustrated. And he was so much like his grandfather, Westy Whizzer, who we talked about earlier, but he was much faster than Westy Whizzer. Whizzer had great speed, but this Greyhound was something else. He was a true machine and a beast. He won so many races. 1977 was his key year. He won 16 out of 20 at Hollywood. He won the Biscayne Irish American. He won the Battle of Ages up at Wonderland. Jim Frey took him to Black Hills, where I'm residing now, for a match race with the Black Hills' star at the time. And of course, Downing won it in track record time. He did something very similar to what his grandfather, Westy Whizzer, did. Remember when I said Whizzer went to Raynham and actually ran in a 3/8 derby, and which was not his forte? Well, they did the same thing with Downing and took him to Taunton to run in the American Derby, a 3/8 race. And just like Whizzer breaking the Raynham track record in one of his eliminations, Downing broke the Taunton 3A's track record in one of his eliminations. Then it went on to win the American Derby. He won the Royal Rube Award as the best sprinter in America that year and finished second in the Flashy Sir Award voting as the best distance greyhound in America. So this was the kind of celebrity and greatness and the way that he responded so wonderfully to every challenge put up to him. The only downside on Downing was the shortness of his career. He was so fast, and his injury prevented him to follow up with ensuing years of greatness like Westy Whizzer or Miss World had done. But he was voted the greyhound of a decade in the 70s, and eventually was voted the greyhound of the century in a poll by the Greyhound Review back in the 2000. He was a super sire for Keith Dillon. He's in the pedigrees of most every greyhound in the United States these days. He was syndicated for, I think it was a $500,000 syndication. He went on to make over $1 million at stud. And he was the youngest inductee ever when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1984. So the great Downing, unparalleled, an amazing greyhound.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Gary, you did a little extra credit work, and you've got some honorable mentions. You want to tell us about those?
Well, just quickly, I just want to name some names that were in consideration here. And this is all personal opinion. As Charlie knows, there's other people who would put these greyhounds in different positions than we would or would have included them. The great Rocking Ship, he was the import from Ireland, the only Irish import to ever be inducted in the Greyhound Hall of Fame. Super Greyhound, marathon racer for Pat Dalton and Don Cuddy, all Hall of Famers themselves. Unfortunately, his life ended before he could have a chance at stud. He was bitten by a snake or a spider, a poisonous thing that happened in 1973. Dutch Bahama was another one, another great Greyhound. He emulated Real Huntsman's feat of winning two straight American Derbies and ran at a lot of different tracks. Won the Biscayne Irish American, could run various distances, and went on to be a super sire. There were a lot of other greyhounds that could have been considered. Pease Rambling, who won the most, I think most Americans would agree, the most dramatic race ever at the Hollywoodian one year. Bumped a couple times, last came on in the race and ended up winning over Prince Proper in a very dramatic photo. And then other greyhounds, EJ's Douglas, who was the champion of the 90s in America. Keith Dillon had three greyhounds that a composite of those three would easily have made the list of Perceive, Kiefer, and Understood, amazing greyhounds. LL's Doug, Rooster Cogburn, Mo Kick, Lucky Pilot himself, all of those greyhounds would be on many people's lists of the greatest in America, depending on what your definition of the greatest is. But all these greyhounds were just super champions, and it's a great thing for us to honor them and idolize them, and what keeps us so interested and intrigued about our great sport.
Yeah, that's the best part of it, isn't it? There's really no way to say objectively by any particular metric who the greatest racing greyhound of all time was. They all were outstanding. All the ones that have been mentioned by the two of you were outstanding in their own way. It's almost a good thing. You can't really, there's no one central criterion by which you name the greatest racing greyhound of all time.
I would say, John, you know, having to choose five historically, if you like, great greyhounds is in some way a little deceptive, because if you said to me, what's the fastest greyhound that you ever saw on a greyhound track, it wouldn't be any of the five that I've mentioned. It would have been a dog called Yellow Printer, which ran at the turn of the 1970s, the end of the 60s. And he did win the Irish Greyhound Derby in the end, but he didn't manage to win the English Derby, for which he was a hot favorite. But I saw Yellow Printer run at the White City, which undeniably to me was the best greyhound track I've ever been to. And he was quite definitely the fastest dog that I've ever seen. And he, of course, was exported to the United States, where he was, a great success at stud. But what a flyer he was. Absolute cracking dog was Yellow Printer.
Yes, and yeah, that brings up the point that when you say the fastest, the next question is always over what distance, right?
True.
Well, there's only one distance.
Go ahead.
To me, there's only one distance. That is 525 yards, not meters, not inches. It's 525 yards. And why were all the tracks, the early tracks in Europe, over 525 yards? Well, it just happened to be when they stepped it out, General Critchley and the rest of his crew, when they stepped out the track around the old stadium at the White City, which had been built for the Olympics in 1908, they found that the race distance would be, with the traps where they wanted them, would be 525 yards. So that set the standard for everyone else. And then for years and years and years in England and in Ireland, the standard distance was 525 yards. We all knew what we were doing. We were all managing to compare one greyhound with another and one stadium with another. And then along comes some wretched people at the National Greyhound Racing Club who feel that in these European days, we must move over to meters. And the whole thing went up in the air. God, Rob.
Gary, do you have a view as to what the definitive distance for greyhound racing is?
Well, America, being as diverse as our country is, it just bounced around depending on who was the superstar at any particular distance. I mean, Miss World was a 3/8 great. Marathons were idolized for a while when you had Rocking Ship and Marathon Hound and F.B. Stutz says Unruly was really a marathon greyhound. He went on to even be a good stud dog, amazingly. So, but one greyhound I forgot, and when Charlie mentioned about the fastest he'd ever seen, I forgot to mention, and he was actually sixth on my list, was Kay's Flack. When he was healthy and sound, this animal was an absolute beast. He would win stake races against America's Best by 10, 11, 12 races. And, a lot of people would have picked Kay's Flack as perhaps our fastest. I don't know that he ever ran in any match races, but if he did, I think he might have had a record that could have rivaled Real Huntsman's 9 for 9. So Kay's Flack was certainly another one worthy of that. But it's interesting. When Downing was running, it was the 5/16. When Miss World was running, 3/8 kind of shined. And when Marathon Hound was running and Rocking Ship, there was a lot of attention given to the marathon greyhounds at the time. But I agree with Charlie on one point. It seemed like the farther distance greyhounds, the ones that ran the longer races, were not the best stud prospects. Rarely did they produce. Unruly was probably the exception to that.
Very interesting. Yeah, absolutely. Charlie, we would be remiss if we didn't take note of the fact that your most recent book of Greyhound History, 22 Waterloo Cups, is now sold out. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, John. Thank you. It's been very pleasing. And I apologize to everyone who wanted a copy, but sadly, they've been too late.
But there is one Charlie Blanning book that's still available. And you want to tell us a little bit about that and how you get it?
Yes, this is a book called Please Mister, The Golden Age of Greyhound Racing. It's available simply on eBay. You can find it there. And it doesn't matter whether you're going to pay in dollars or pounds or euros or whatever. Because it's on eBay, it's easy to buy. Please Mister is a history, particularly of the early days of greyhound racing, how greyhound racing started, I received invaluable assistance from the family of Owen Patrick Smith, who invented the first electric-driven lure for greyhound racing. And I think probably I was very fortunate with this one, in as far as that the printers made me an offer that I simply couldn't refuse. And therefore, we had more of Please Mister than we had of The Greyhound and the Hare, my previous book, and of the subsequent 22 Waterloo Cups. So we still have copies of Please Mister available. You may want to know why it has such a curious title. And that's because this all happened not very far away from where Gary now lives in South Dakota, at a place called Hot Springs in South Dakota, where they were holding a coursing meeting. And Owen Patrick Smith was the secretary of the coursing meeting, the national coursing meeting, and he found a little girl came up while they were running and tugged him by his coat. And she said, "Please, mister." And Smith looked down and said, "Go away, little girl, go away." She said, "Please, mister, do they really have to kill the rabbit?" And it was a lightning moment, a Damascene moment for O.P. Smith. And he thought, well, do they have to kill the rabbit? So then he started his experiments in producing an electricity-driven lure. And after many years and many frustrating setbacks, he managed to get greyhound racing going, as we all know, in Emeryville, California. And the book covers all that, and much later as well, much more, as they always say. So obviously, as the author, I recommend it.
It's a fabulous book.
Well, and let everybody know that if, you know, when it's gone, it's gone. There's not going to be more copies printed. So just as with The Greyhound and the Hare and 22 Waterloo Cups, yeah, you need to jump on it. Gentlemen, it's been a great time to spend with you virtually here, if nothing else. It's still my goal, Gary, to get you and Charlotte together once again. It's been, what, 20, 30 years since you've been in the same place at one time. So we hope to change that in the coming years or two. We're trying to get Charlie and his wife, Sheila, to come over. And when they do, we'll make sure we get together with you as well.
Very good. Would love that, John.
Thank you very much, John. Look forward to it.
So, Greyhound lovers, that's it for today. Please watch our podcast on YouTube, or you can listen to it on any of your favorite podcast apps. We'll put a link in our show notes to the way to get Please Mister, and we'll see you again at the next episode.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. If you're not a regular listener, be sure to follow Greyhound Nation wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for Grey Nation Show, follow us, and you'll get notifications every time we release a new episode. You can also get new show notifications when you subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you liked the episode, leave us a review on our Facebook page or your favorite podcast app. You can also send us feedback or questions via the contact form on our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. This episode was produced in collaboration with host John Parker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dimitri Taras. We'd like to thank our guests this episode, Charlie Blanning and Gary Guccione. Don't forget to visit Charlie's Facebook page, The Greyhound and the Hare, if you'd like to order one of the few remaining copies of his second book, Please Mister. I'm Michael Burns, and you've been listening to Greyhound Nation.